Wednesday, May 29th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Two guys, two old friends, both in their 30s, are talking, haven't seen each other for a couple years. Danny, how are you? John, what's up? What's been going on? Oh, I've been good. You know, Emily and I got married. Yeah, I got the invite. And, oh, yes, I meant to thank you for the gift. I know you couldn't come. Yeah, it's no problem. It was far away. But, I don't know, just been going through, like, some neighborhood bullshit. Really? Me too. Was yours political? Mine was totally political. Oh, my God, what happened? So Danny says, well, you know, after the Dobbs ruling, after the abortion case, Hannah was just like despondent. John's like, oh, Emily too. So I told her, you should, you know, you can't just sit here and stew. You go out. It's America. You could do something. You could protest. Me too. We put up a sign. We went to a protest. It at least allowed us an outlet. So that helped. Absolutely. It really did. But so where's the neighborhood bullshit? Well, you know, we have, I don't know if you know I told you, but there is this older couple who lives down the cul-de-sac. And we were staying with Emily's mom during the pandemic. And, you know, this was January 6th and the insurrection got really, really horrible. So we put up a sign. We put up a sign or two, right? Like, whatever, fuck Trump and buy Don, you know, that one. And then Danny's like, yeah, I know, not the best pun. We put up we just put up some Biden-Harris 2020 signs. I mean, it gives us something to do. Absolutely. So what happened in our case was this older couple who lives down the block did not like the signs. Really? The same thing happened to us. And what did your older couple who lives down the block do? Well, and this is John talking, you know, Emily got in Emily's face, the woman of the couple. She like runs out of her car one day and starts yelling at her. And then we think she even spit at us. She was just so mad. What about yours? And Danny's like, yep. It was, you know, the husband and the wife and just like pointed fingers. And we used to be more or less high-by type neighbors. And now just the glares and we heard her say disgusting under her breath once. Well, listen to this. So our neighbors, she flies an upside-down flag right at us. What the hell's an upside-down flag even mean? I don't know. I didn't even know what to think of it. And then I started doing some research, and it turns out the January 6th insurrectionists also had the upside-down flag. Holy shit, she's an insurrectionist? I don't know if she's an insurrectionist. I mean, you know, they're like an upstanding couple. I don't know that they would want to be identified with that. And then Danny says, yeah, mine too. I mean, the husband in my couple, he's a lawyer, and I think she was a teacher. That's so weird, says John. Mine's a lawyer, and his wife was a librarian, and she doesn't work, but he still works into his 70s. I think he's about 70. And then Danny says, oh yeah, what kind of, my guy was, I think like personal injury, and he's not, never really said anything to us, but just been bad blood and it's been horrible. What kind of law did your guy do? Oh, he's Samuel Alito, Justice of the Supreme Court. And that basically comports with, I made up. Thank you for allowing me the latitude. I made up the Danny character married to Hannah. But John, don't know his name, was Emily Baden's then fiance. Now it's her husband. There was the allegations of spitting. There was bad blood. There was also a Christmas card that said, may you have peace, with peace in bold and caps sent to us. I threw it out. Now, personally, if I got any sort of handwritten missive from justice on the Supreme Court, I'd have kept it. That's just me, and that's how I differ. But, you know, cul-de-sacs, neighbors, states that are not quite beet red, not quite ice blue, these things are going to happen. And sometimes they wind up on the front page of the New York Times. Emily Baden, by the way, I checked her credits because she's a former actress. She was in one episode of Kimmy Schmidt. She played a character named Gorb. And I shall, at the end of the show, as a special Easter egg, play all of the dialogue around Gorb, the character Emily played in season 4 of Kimmy Schmidt. Thank you, the Mighty Pesca players, I believe and I hope have given you more illumination and insight into the very human causes of the Justice Alito flag flap part 3. On the show today, I apologize for wasting your time with a very important story that turned out not to be important, although pandas were shipped FedEx in the first story. But first, I'm going to pick up where I left off yesterday with David Ignatius, Washington Post columnist and author of a new novel, Phantom Orbit, a thriller. David has covered the Middle East for many years, and we're going to drill down on what exactly is going on in Gaza, at least as seen through the eyes of all of the top officials who use David Ignatius to get their messages out to the world and each other. David Ignatius up next. David Ignatius is out with a new geopolitical thriller, Phantom Orbit. Yesterday, we talked broadly about his work, both in the fictional world that he creates for his novels and the real world, this one, the real world. And that's his job as columnist for The Washington Post. Today, we will go further into the war in Gaza. This is a part of the world he has a lot of experience in, both as a journalist and the son of the former Secretary of the Navy. Let us pick up our conversation there.
I think it's beneficial.
Sometimes media reports, or we'll use a construction like U.S. military officials believe that the outright defeat of Hamas is impossible. And sometimes the threshold is, to use a quote from an Israeli officials, where they declare a total defeat of Hamas. And then against that quote, you could say, well, that's probably not going to happen. But my question is, how pervasive, or what has your reporting indicated about you use whichever term you want to best communicate the idea of removing Hamas as an immediate and maybe even medium to long-term threat to the security of Israel due to military actions? Do U.S. military officials say that that is an impossible goal?
So even in the first weeks of the war, take the best example is President Biden's visit to Israel as the war was, still hot. And he went into the war zone, good for him. And as it was described at the time, he embraced it. And Israel was very traumatized by what had happened, a leadership that was really struggling. And he said two things that were important. The United States stands with you as an ally. This was at a time when Israel was still afraid that Hezbollah might open up with rockets from the north. We stand with you. But then second, he said, be careful about overreacting. And he used, as I did the day after October 7, my first real commentary, think about the 9/11 analogy and how shaken we were. First, how we didn't see it coming. You know, we had an intelligence failure like Israel's failure before October 7. All the pieces were there to understand it, but you couldn't see them and assemble them. And then when you're hit like that in a way that surprises you and it's outrageous, it's just, what happened on October 7 was barbaric, as what happened on 9/11, flying airplanes into buildings, those people jumping out the windows. It's just still horrifying. So there's a tendency to overreact and make decisions that are unwise. And Biden had the good sense to say that to the Israeli people. I don't think people listen to him. And I think a lot of the problems that have developed are that this natural human tendency, when you've been pounded and you're reeling and you want to strike back, and that's really what you're not thinking about the day after. You're thinking about now and avenging the terrible deaths and the hostages who were underground. But Biden tried to say the useful thing, and I did too in my journalism. Be careful, think. I began writing about the day after, right at the beginning of the war. And so I think that's something that we can do. We just know it's a human, just look at ourselves. You want to understand Israel now, look at the United States after 9/11, because it's so similar.
What do U.S. top military officials believe can be achieved militarily?
So I think the U.S. has come to believe that there is sufficient degradation, is the word they use, of Hamas's organized military capability that it cannot threaten Israel again in the way that it did on October 7 and has historically, that it's basically busted up. I use the number 75% of its organized military capability is destroyed, according to the Israelis, in my most recent piece.
Mm-hmm. And you believe that? 75 is an accurate figure?
I do.
Does that mean 30,000 out of 40,000 fighters, or 75% of the tunnels, or what?
So what it means to me, and maybe I should spell this out in my comments, what it means to me is the organized, commanded, and controlled functioning of the fighters. I think, you know, many fighters survive. One of the things that bothers me about this war is that the ratio of civilians killed to fighters killed seems just unusually, unacceptably high. So I think there are still a lot of Hamas people out there, but they were highly structured. They were pretty disciplined. And I think that's been shattered. And the Israelis want to finish that in Rafah, and they're trying to find ways to do that that involve less loss of civilian life. It's crucial that be done. But I think that they then say, when the organized military power of Hamas is broken, it becomes a guerrilla force with scattered nodes that's still dangerous, as we see, though. Come out of tunnels, they'll, you know, form into little units, but it will be a security problem like what Israel deals with all the time in the West Bank. And the West Bank, I spent a week in the West Bank top to bottom. Palestinians in the West Bank hate the fact that the Israeli military, the IDF, stages raids, you know, a couple times a week, in areas that the Palestinians nominally control, but where they just aren't dealing with security threats from Hamas people or other militant groups, and in goes an IDF task force, and pow, you know, it'll arrest people. And so that the argument is that's what the West Bank, that's what Gaza may look like in the future, sort of like the West Bank does now. It'll have governance. Hopefully, it'll get better. Hopefully, we and the Saudis and the Egyptians will train up Palestinian security forces that are competent, that maintain law and order, that have liaison with Israel. But there still is going to be something like those, you know, recurring intelligence-driven raids to take out pockets. That's their view, that if the organized military power is destroyed, that's what you're dealing with, and that's something that they know how to do and think they can do effectively.
And are you saying that they're saying that Israel can get there with future Gaza operations, might be surrounding Gaza, might not be invading Gaza, or right now, if there was a general pullout, that could be the situation in Gaza?
So there's already been a general pullout. I mean, in April, yeah, they pulled major combat units back. What's remaining are forces. Some have had to go back in to fight these new clearing operations in Jabalia, in Gaza City. But you know, mainly it's still down to the south. But so the thing that worries me when I think about the future from everybody's standpoint, Palestinians, Israelis, and everybody else, is that the operation that Israel has been conducting is creating, I've likened it to Somalia, meaning it's just a lawless area governed by thieves, tribal warlords. Everything that's brought in by humanitarian groups gets ripped off. There's no security for everybody. It's just a mess. I mean, somebody has to control that. We think, we got to get this humanitarian supplies in. And it's true, there's people desperate suffering. But as soon as the stuff gets there, armed gunmen try to rip it off and sell it. And so how's that going to be controlled? And that's something that the Netanyahu government has not thought through. Thank goodness to me, the IDF is now thinking this is a problem we have to worry about. And they're beginning to come up with some reasonable ideas.
I want to ask you about one thing you just said, that the ratio of civilians to militants seems unusually high. I've heard from others like John Spencer of West Point in the Army, who makes the opposite point. We don't know what the figures are, but it's something like 20,000 civilians dead, something like 10,000 combatants dead. I mean, these are Netanyahu-esque figures, but they're not really belied by what the Hamas Ministry of Health is saying. Is that high or is that low for an urban warfare situation?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a fair question. I I'd need to look more at historical evidence. It's certainly, if you look at World War II, if you look at the bombing of Hiroshima, supposedly Harry Truman thought a military target. It wasn't. It was a civilian target, and civilians were killed in vastly larger right. numbers than military. But you know, 2-1 civilians over military, you know, Palestinian civilians over Hamas fighters seems higher than it should be.
Okay.
You know, precisely what it is. I can't go into the details. I just have that in feeling, and I hear that from many Americans who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. They may have had high civilian casualty levels, but they tried to mitigate them. They had elaborate systems, you know, algorithms into which they'd feed all the data about where people were. Sometimes when there was major civilian loss of life, it was because partner forces, you know, as in Mosul, a lot of that operation was done by the Iraqi military, and they just blew in, and they wanted to kill ISIS, and anybody supported it,
right?
But
and let that be a lesson. I mean, when it's their territory and their home, they're going to proceed with less caution than, say, yep. force like the United States.
Well, and Israel, you know, that's what Israel's. So I've talked through with Israeli Air Force targeters what the rules of engagement are. To minimize civilian casualties to the greatest extent possible, even given that, you know, Hamas uses human shields. I mean, they know this is a problem because they understand there's an international support dimension of the war that they've got to be attentive to. So they do take it seriously. The problem is that those rules of engagement kept getting overridden. The rules are structured on obviously, inevitably. So if it's a question of protecting Israeli soldiers, Israeli lives, you're just going to override some. The other problem was the tunnels. They really didn't reckon on how extensive, deep, or difficult the tunnel network would be. So in the early days of the war, using heavy ordnance, really going after the tunnels, but there were all these buildings on top, man. It was just a very difficult military problem. But I think looking back, I'd be surprised if senior Israeli commanders didn't think, looking back, we should have done this in a way that gave us less international obstacles to conducting the military operation that we want. I'd be really interested in what are Israeli lessons learned when we get away from the kind of back and forth and the angry debate about this. What are the lessons that the Israelis take away from this about how to conduct operations in the future?
Another question about your understanding of the thinking of top U.S. military officials. Some of them, probably the generals and people with a lot of stars on their shoulders, go back a long way. They go back to the fight against Al-Qaeda. And I'm reading a Politico article from today or yesterday. Top officials are publicly calling Israel's strategy in Gaza self-defeating and likely to open the door to Hamas's return. It's, you know, something like the flypaper theory of terrorism, or if you kill for every one insurgent you kill, you create 10 more. But do these top officials who are veterans of the fight against Al-Qaeda, do they say to themselves, well, this was the exact criticism or predictions that were levied against us? And then do they say, and we did essentially defeat Al-Qaeda, allowing for the fact that Al-Qaeda is a franchise and there's an Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and other splinter organizations that use the title. So that's my question. Do they say some of the arguments being used against Israel were used against us, but we were able to defeat this insurgent or terroristic force? Or, I mean, there can be a lot of reasons they don't think that. They don't think, maybe it's that they don't think they truly defeated Al-Qaeda. Maybe they think Al-Qaeda is so different than Hamas. Maybe they think that what Israel is doing is self-defeating in a way what the United States did wasn't.
So it's a good question. I think some of the criticism from retired military officers is the kind of stuff you get from formers criticizing, you know, current operators. Hindsight is always 20/20. The The one point I'd make is that as our forever wars went on, Israel's doesn't last as long as ours did, but as they went on, the U.S. did take issues like civilian casualties much more seriously for precisely the reason that you say, that people began to understand that you can't kill your way out of this, that for every person you kill, you're likely to create additional recruits. And so in targeting and operations, people involved different rules of operation. We did partner effectively with the Iraqis, and slowly with that partnership, ISIS, which was a real threat, I think. Just a really ultra-violent group was contained, pushed back. I spent a lot of time traveling with our special forces in Syria, where we had a partner force in the Syrian Kurds, so-called Syrian Democratic Front, that was an ideal partner in that it operated very closely with the U.S. It did think about civilian casualties. There were a lot. I mean, you look at Raqqa, and man, it looks like Gaza City. It had not been to Raqqa twice after it was, quote, liberated, close quote, and it was just pounded. But there was a learning process, and I think our commanders now are advising Israel on things they learned when our story was ending about how to do it right, that in truth they didn't understand in the beginning and middle when they weren't doing it so right. We're getting deeper in the big muddy, so to speak.
Mm. I think through your reporting and just the facts of policy as publicly announced, that Joe Biden was trying to rhetorically signal his displeasure and also put some of that rhetoric into effect by denying certain kinds of munitions to the Israelis. And he politically, I don't know what other options he had, but he and the administration thought or hoped that he would get credit for both his rhetoric, which is tough talk and public displeasure, and his actions, which are essentially to keep funding the war. Credit for both. I see him getting criticized for both. So he's not getting credit for the rhetoric, because everyone who would respond well to the rhetoric is saying, well, you're still giving the munitions to Israel. And he's not getting much credit for still funding Israel, because the biggest allies or proponents of the Israeli agenda in the United States are very offended and upset that he's not standing by them rhetorically. So what's your assessment? I guess this is a domestic politics question, but you also know what people inside the administration think about how this is playing out. What do you think?
So I don't think he's getting much political credit. He's probably getting political damage from being in the middle ground that is classic Biden territory. I think he's generally doing it right. The thing that is concerning me the most is we have said, Biden has said correctly, that the welfare of Palestinian civilians, as this war continues and as Hamas's political power is destroyed, which I favor, I think Hamas has been a dreadful leader in Gaza, and I don't want to see them ever govern Gaza again. But as that goal is pursued, we have said that the humanitarian mission, you know, that dimension of the war is something the United States is committed to as a country. And we've done airdrops, and we built this pier, but it's not enough. And we've said to Israel, we're going to cut off weapons if you do an all-out assault on Rafah. And you know what? They decide they won't do an all-out assault on Rafah. They're not going to do that. But those, unfortunately, the fear of an attack on Rafah now has, I'm told, well over a million people on the march again, on the road. I've watched. So, Mike, I was in Gaza City, with the IDF, watching the first migration south from Gaza City of those people who ended up in Rafah. It was like the first day it opened up, and the Israelis were trying to protect them, and, mortars are going off. It's crazy. But, there was this line just to the end of the horizon. A Palestinian is just carrying a suitcase, just looking like end of the earth, and walking toward Rafah. And so they get to Rafah, and now they're told to walk back somewhere, and they don't know where. And, you know, that's just not right. And the U.S. has said, we're going to in some way be there to protect you. And I think the U.S. has to be more forceful. I don't quite know how we should do this, but I think we have to be more forceful in living up to that commitment that we've made. We're not saying that you should give up and let Hamas run Gaza. We are saying those protection of those people is something that the United States is committed to. And I hope they'll follow through. And there's quite a debate in the administration now about it. And the people who argue this, you know, the Berlin airlift is a wonderful example. When we decide we really want to do something important to help people, we do it. And something like that needs to happen. I don't know what exactly the shape is. I think the Pentagon doesn't want to get involved. They're dragging their feet on this. But this is something I feel pretty, as you can tell, I feel pretty strongly about. I think the humanitarian mission matters.
David Ignatius is the Washington Post foreign affairs columnist and the writer of thrillers, the latest of which is titled Phantom Orbit. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
And now the spiel. I have an apology. I want to apologize. I got something wrong. Not a fact wrong. Sure, I did that too. Not a pronunciation. I get those wrong all the time. I got a supposed development wrong. It did not develop. I should have been savvier because I pride myself on not falling for these stories of change. I never fall for the first superhero who, whatever, is Muslim, Uyghur, handicapped, handicapable, AI-generated, has a subprime mortgage, running for office on the Green Party line. You always see that press release, and the New York Times will often do a short story on it. I don't cover comics. I'm not about to fall for the comic news that supposedly breaks because a classic character who didn't stay dead is now back, and they're more Hindu than ever. Maybe they are, in fact, the first something, and I celebrate that, but usually what happens is they'll announce a comic book character as the first something, and then some nerd will come along and say, actually, in page 14 of She-Hulk, annual number 4, it's strongly implied that Megalodorn is both colorblind and a Uyghur. So I save you the trouble. I don't fall for that, and therefore you won't fall for that. You don't have to care. You get to care about other things. I also didn't make you care about the Queen's death. Remember that one? Barely covered it. I think this is true. I think I could swear to this. I've never and will never give you stories about how preparations for the Olympics or the World Cup are behind schedule, because I covered a lot of these things and there never was one where preparations weren't behind schedule. And then I checked, there's always an Olympics. I'm not saying they hit the schedule, they just have the Olympics and maybe some trains don't work. But inevitably, South Koreans do well in archery, and a country whose border is formed by the Danube does well in water polo. A cousin of the not falling for it tendency is the claim that this or that iconic brand is no more. Twinkies, gone. Wonder Bread, gone. Very recently, Red Lobster, gone. Come on. It is so hard to gain purchase in the national consciousness, even if sales are down, that mind share is not to be thrown away easily. It's crazy to think that. And it's nice to have the nostalgic pieces that say, oh my gosh, can you believe there are no more Twinkies? But the fact that those pieces drive traffic tell you that there is an appetite, literally and perhaps intellectually, for Twinkies. Someone is going to give the brand a go. I was, however, a bit shy of proclaiming this as a general rule and hyping my 1,000 batting average for fear that one of my old tweets would be exposed. In 2017, the headlines were all over. I'll quote one from the Wall Street Journal, January 16, 2017. The greatest show on earth is coming to an end. What that signals for the circus industry. And oh, what an industry. They say that industry is dying and the circus industry leads the way or follows, trunk to tail style. So Ringling Brothers was gone. Animal activists had protested it out of existence, but I did not buy it. And I tweeted at that time atop that very headline, like the supposed death of Twinkies, I predict that Ringling Brothers is too valuable a brand to completely let wither. But then nothing. Silence. The tigers didn't roar. The elephants were shipped off and rehabbed. And I, for a time, it's very tough to live with, I thought I might be wrong. Until 6 months ago.
After shutting down in 2017, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey is back. Its relaunch a week ago in Bossier City, Louisiana, the first stop on a two-year tour.
Yes, that was from CBS This Morning. The key was there were to be no more animal acts in the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey circus. Bailey, by the way, getting short shrift as a circus pioneer. Barnum gets his due. Ringling Brothers, kind of name above the headline. But the Bailey Circus? Oh, the circus aficionados know that the Bailey Circus, that was the money circus. Anyway, no more animal acts. This is seen as a great feat of humanity. But it also means that, to excite the people who go to the circus, that the tightrope walkers, that the unicyclists, that the daredevils will have to indulge or dare their devilish nature at a more dangerous, higher, without a net setting than ever before.
Instead of a single high wire, the Lopez family, Ringling veterans, are walking three at once, 25 feet up.
What they're making unique, the boys, they're gonna do something they never been done before, like to do a handstand on the bicycle on the top of the high wire without any safety harness.
Maria Pontigo Lopez.
Is it 10 times harder, 50 times harder, 100 times harder?
I think it's a thousand times harder.
Maybe we can introduce a poodle act? Save the lives of that nice lady's family? No? I mean, look, it doesn't have to be elephants. I'm not saying the elephants. Let them retire to their elephant places. But the circus, Ringling Brothers literally had dog acts, so a dog would walk around on its hind legs and jump through a hoop. Maybe a monkey messes with the dog, right? Okay, sorry, Lopez's, you will certainly die. But you know what? We did save a bear who, I don't know, maybe would have liked tricycling if he was just exposed to it. Anyway, this does bring me to my apology. Sort of a brand that I got wrong, sort of a news development, but I bought it. I bought it at the time, and I brought it to you. I miscalculated. It was not just a brand. It was almost a geopolitical miscalculation. Or maybe I just wanted to make some panda puns. But I did all those months ago. I thought it was important to alert you of the development.
We're back now with a long goodbye at the National Zoo. Three giant pandas are set to head to China after captivating millions for decades.
But now, like Twinkies, like the Ringling Brothers, like I predict Red Lobster, we now bring you this Earth Sign update from WUSA Channel 9 DC.
Back to the huge breaking news at this hour. The millions of fans who mourned when all the National Zoo's giant pandas went back to China last year can rejoice this morning.
And it's nice to have some good breaking news, right? This is really joyful. Just an hour ago, the zoo announced plans for new pandas to come to the district, including their names and their video.
The station got into even more details than we could ever have dreamed of.
So who's coming? Two new pandas. We're getting Ching Bao and we're getting Bao Li. Now, Bao Li, look real close at his picture there. As you can see, a little bit of resemblance. That's because
Bao Li is a panda and he resembles other pandas. You don't have to do a 23andMe Bao Li to figure out that this panda looks like every other panda you've ever seen. Uniformity of pandas, it's what makes the panda, like any good brand, a replicable crowd pleaser. Maybe I should apologize for throwing you the idiocy inherent in panda coverage. Never mind the great panda fake out that I helped perpetuate. So yeah, sometimes the news, like an iPhone, gets me with their forced obsolescence, the fake fade out, the scarcity mindset. It's infectious. Or maybe You think that all the iterations of nothing much happening amounts to something happening? It's very tempting. There'll probably be a couple days of deliberation in the Trump trial. I'm here to tell you that day one of deliberations is not very different to us, the news consumers, than day two of the deliberations will be. And I will deliberately not be updated. Wait, what's that? The verdict is in. He's guilty of loving the pandas. Those playful visitors will surely delight millions with their amiable waddling and adorable sexlessness. They've put the roly-poly in diplomacy. And when they've gone, we're sure gonna miss them. You know, it's just nice to finally have a good news story every once in a while. Also, polio is cured, and because of treatments, no one in the world died of Ebola last year, we think. But, oh, wait, oh, Bolie's eating bamboo. Who does he look like when he does that? Now that is good news. And that's it for today's show. Corey Ware is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson is the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of having a birthday today. Wish her happy birthday. The Gist is presented in charge of Libsyn's Advertise Cast. For advertise inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oomperoo, gee-peroo, do-peroo, and thanks for listening.
Ever since the pandas came to Washington, I've made kind of a periodic trek here to see them. And I just think it's really just, it's so sad that they are all going to be leaving at the same time.
Big panda fan, been in D.C. for 23 years now, so visited them many times, seen the babies born over the years, and it's really, really sad, heartbreaking to see them go back to China, and hopefully we can work something out in the future for more pandas.
I miss you. I really want to cuddle with you.